blimey. It's been a while, hasn't it? How are you doing? Well, thank you for staying subscribed to the RSS feed if you're listening to this on your podcasting catching app. I appreciate your optimism that one day this would happen and we'd bring the insider back. But that's exactly what we've done. And you know it's a short show, so I'm not going to waffle. I'm just going to get started and bring on the guest. What I'd love, though, is if you're happy to see it back, tell me. Post it on social media. Share it with your friends. Let's get even more people than usual to listen to The Insider. That being said, let's crack on with today's guest, the amazing Dan Harlan. Hello and welcome to today's episode of The Insider, brought to you, as ever, by Vanishing Ink. My guest today first hit the magic scene with his original rubber band magic, then went on to create a bunch of best-selling tricks, including the legendary Cardtoon, Starcore, Hovercard, and many, many more. He's full Penn & Teller. He's filmed his own twists on every single trick in Tarbell, has consulted for the biggest names in magic, and probably taught magic to more people than anybody else in the world with his books, videos, and tricks. From rubber bands to kids' shows to close-up to stage to mentalism, there is really nothing this man can't do. It's Dan Harlan. Dan, how are you?
I am humbled and thrilled. Thank you so much for the introduction. I'm going to make one correction. I have never published a book. That's it. But it doesn't mean I'm not publishing a book. Let's lead with that. You know, I'm here to tell you what's going on. Yeah, I'm taking time out of my extremely busy schedule of writing, illustrating, laying out, producing my books, my masterworks, three huge volumes that will cover my whole career. But we're not here to talk about that.
I've got a question on that.
Well, I'm also a mind reader. I know what your questions are going to be. You can just sit there and I will answer all your questions.
Okay, go. What's the first question?
I first got interested in magic at a very young age.
You got 23 seconds. 23 seconds.
To finish that answer.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I was interested in magic because I saw magicians at my grade school. My grade school principal was a magician. I didn't know it at the time, but we saw every touring act. And then I asked for a magic kit. It was the year of Marshall Brodeen, TV magic, all of that kind of stuff here in America. And so my grandmother bought me a magic set, and I was just...
Sorry, I'm just hopping in here because in the edit, something weird happened and Dan's answer petered out, but it was the same as everybody else's answer. So let's move on. Now, it's possible that Vanishing Ink might be shortly releasing a new version of Cardtoon.
I've heard this rumor. I've heard it over a year ago, in fact. Come on, Vanishing Ink.
Oh, we're busy people, Dan. We're busy people. Yes. How did you come up with the idea for what is now, frankly, a neoclassic effect in card magic?
Well, you know, while I was a full-time magician, I was also a full-time graphic designer. So I did both things professionally, concurrently. And so part of my graphic design filtered into part of the magic that I was creating. And I happened to be coming off of a big lecture tour that was on the East Coast. And I was driving back from Boston, I remember specifically, on a very long night because I had to get back to my regular day job. And it was more 10, 12 hour drive, something. It was insane. And so what I would do is I would try to keep myself awake during that time. Mm-hmm. And I would just come up with ideas for magic tricks. And really more what it was thinking of what are some amazing things that we take for granted, like electricity and flight and things like that. But just one of them that crossed the radar there that particular time was animation. And since I was already a graphic designer, already an artist, it struck a chord with me. And so I wrote down the idea of animation. And I started to think about doing a flip book kind of animation where you could reorder everything and create something different. you know, maybe with a pharaoh or something. None of it made any sense. But by the time I got done with that drive, I had already figured out that all I had to do was place one last image after a sequence, and it would seem like the whole sequence was leading up to it. And then I had decided, well, that's going to be cards. It was easy to apply to a card trick. If you've got, I don't want to encourage everybody to do this, but if you've got an idea that's never been tried before and it's kind of complicated, the easiest thing to test it on is a card trick. It isn't always necessarily the best thing to keep it with, but in this case, it happened to work out nicely. So, you know, I did that drive. I got home. I was exhausted. And instead of going to sleep like I should have, I grabbed a deck of cards and started drawing on the back of them. I took maybe a 20-minute nap before I went into work that day. I was worthless at work because it's all I could think about. And then I got home and I worked on it again. It was just one of those moments of serendipity that, because I already had all of the skills necessary to put it together, I was the perfect guy to put it together.
Let's talk about your early days. Mm-hmm. How did you get started with rubber bands, and how did you start to develop your own work on that genre?
Yeah, well, you know, I had, first of all, the major influence was that I had a paper route. You know, I delivered newspapers, and so I had a big bag of rubber bands. And at my grade school, in addition to my principal being a magician, we also had like a school counselor that helped kids with any issues that they had. And it's, you know, simple stuff, right? But he heard that I was interested in magic, and he showed me the jumping rubber band trick, the Stanley Collins jumping rubber band. And so I loved it. And it was one of those things where I had rubber bands at home. I could show everybody. I could do this thing. But I was also just studying variations on string tricks and other things. And so I really liked the idea of rubber bands, but I didn't do much with it until many years later. I think I was about 20 years old when Bill Kalush and a few other people were working on the linking rubber bands idea and rubber band and finger ring idea. Jay Sankey was kind of trying things. There was the rubber band through the rising card would come up and the rubber band would go through it. If you remember all of that stuff. So there was a resurgence in interest in rubber band magic. And I I had the world's easiest job. I was a graphic designer for a big company, and I mean, I could knock out graphic design in a second, but I was able to spend most of my day in my little office playing with office supplies to create magic. And then by the end of the day, I would have the page that they needed for that day. Now, that's it, right? So I spent a lot of time coming up with magic tricks with office supplies. And so naturally rubber bands were there. And so I learned, I was inspired and learned all of the Bill Kalush stuff. And I saw Sankey on tour doing his linking rubber band work. And it just didn't resonate with me. It was all too kind of, cozy, too tight. And so I wanted to do something that was much more natural. So I just started playing around with all these ideas and using some things that I had learned in string tricks, because rubber bands essentially become strings, and some cat's cradle. Like I went for that kind of grip to begin with. So again, I was just uniquely qualified to study it in depth and waste my time at work, doing that. And so it all worked out really nicely.
You've hosted, and I think this is a technical term, a metric ton of lectures for Penguin.
Yeah, I think it's a third of a metric ton, actually.
Thank you for correcting me. You've hosted a third of a metric ton of lectures for Penguin, which I understand is a magic company that sells tricks. I'm not familiar with their work. What's a funny / interesting / something behind the scenes story from all of that filming that you've done? Does something pop into your head?
I'm gonna go away from funny and go into scary, frightening. Back when we were
let's do scary
because sure. Those are the worst things for live. Live, anything can happen, right? And you expect that anything while you're recording it, while you're doing it, anything can happen. So you have to handle it. But back when we were live in the studio, there was a large monitor, and on the monitor, there was a countdown. And what we didn't know at the time was one of our audience members live there had epilepsy and got hooked into this countdown, the flickering of it, in such a way that he was having a seizure. And this happened 30 seconds before air. So an audience member in our studio goes into a seizure, and I'm standing on stage, adjusting myself. I don't know what's going on. One of our crew members fortunately saw it and was like, you know, are you all right? Are you all right? And no response. And they were like, you know, we've got to call 911. They're having a seizure, and they figured it out. Nobody else was aware of it except for this one person who happened to be paying attention. And so we back in the tech booth. Everybody's scrambling. They reset the counter so that they put 2 minutes up or whatever they put up. I don't remember what it was. Somebody called 911. Just down the road was the EMS. They showed up, got this guy onto a gurney, wheeled him out into the ambulance and started procedures on him. And then I went live
with
the lecture. And fortunately, the guy survived, made it through absolutely fine. We took that counter off. The countdown, you know, didn't have the scrolling microseconds on it anymore. You know, countdown, you know, slow, much more slowly live. Whoever our lecturer was at that time did a fine job. We were all like completely unsettled. But, you know, it's one of those lectures. If you were a subscriber and you were wondering why the lecture was starting late, we were saving a life.
Goodness me.
Yeah.
Now, in the UK, there is a show called Room 101, based on the Orwellian concept from 1984, mm-hmm. where things that are not appropriate get put into Room mm-hmm. 101. If there was a magic Room 101... what would you put in it, Dan Harlan?
Well, all right. The number one thing that would go into the room for me is the concept of a sucker trick. A trick where you are asking your audience to guess the solution, and then you're telling them it's wrong. Or, right, you know, you're all stupid is what you're saying. You know,
I'm awesome.
Right, I'm awesome, you're stupid. And then the worst offender is the traditional die box, and that, you know, and it's got a long history, and I'm sure that there are going to be plenty of listeners who are like, well, I do the die box, and it's one of the things that gets the best response in my show. Well, if that's true, then the rest of your show sucks. Because the die box doesn't get the best response. It makes the loudest response, but have you ever actually listened to the response that it got? You know, the kids will be yelling, it's over there, turn it around to begin with the first time, and then they'll be yelling, you suck, you're awful, this is dumb, I hate this, you know, because that's what they hate it. They absolutely
yeah. Where's David Kaye?
Right? You don't have to do it in a way that insults your audience, and especially kids, because this is the thing. You're setting them up to think that they know something. And mm-hmm. and these are impressionable children that are learning the way the world operates. And then you're showing them this stupid idea that what they're saying isn't right, but they know it's right because you're showing them the other door, you know, and you're tilting it and they can hear it move. Mm-hmm. And yet you only show them the other door, you spin the box around. So you are insulting their intelligence and acting like an idiot in doing it. So if you as an idiot are brighter than them, what does that make them? And then at the end, you show that they were actually wrong and that all of your idiocy was just to belittle them. Now, you may not agree with me, but if you don't agree with me, you're wrong. You see, it doesn't feel good to be wrong. So why would you want your audience, and especially impressionable children, to feel wrong and less than you? Now, I have empirical evidence to back this up. It has happened to me multiple times in my career that people have seen my show and they say, you know, I don't like magicians, but I actually enjoyed you. And I ask them, well, why don't you like magicians? And invariably, I swear to you, it's happened so often. They will say, well, there was this magician at my birthday party or at a birthday party that I was at, and he did this stupid trick with dice in a box. And you know, and everybody hated him and he was dumb. And then he made us feel awful and we were yelling at him. And I just couldn't stand it. You didn't do anything like that. You didn't make us feel stupid. Right. So, OK. That and honestly, I could put in other things, but let's just go with that, because if there's one thing that I could leave as a legacy, and it doesn't matter all the great things that I've invented, all the things that I intend to keep doing, all that kind of stuff, just please stop doing sucker tricks. And if you need a good example of how to do a trick similar in that vein, look at my Hold It Buster. Hold It Buster I wrote when I was 14 years old. And it's a Monty routine. You know, it's a jumbo card Monty routine. There is no sucker element in that. There is no gambling in that whatsoever. It is filled with very funny things and multiple times of magic, and completely looks like it's real magic, and has a charming story, you know, of a father and a son that everybody can relate to. It's so much stronger than if I was just asking people to guess where the card is and I show them they were wrong. So that. Stepping off the soapbox now.
Conversely, what excites you about magic today?
Well, pretty much everything. I mean, you know, magic has an amazing potential. And I hear people getting down on it all the time about, you know, the virtual venues. You know, people, well, first of all, we were all forced to perform virtually for a few years. But even before that, people were saying, you know, magic on Facebook was awful, and TikTok is the death of magic, and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But it's not. These are all opportunities to show the world magic. And that's what excites me. And that's why something like Penn and Teller Fool Us has done so well. 11 seasons. That's 11 years of just seeing magicians come on and be praised for the quality of their work. You see, the positivity toward the good work that magicians have been doing, you know, locally or regionally or whatever, now gets to be seen on a world stage. So I think that's the most exciting thing. The world, if you're doing good magic, there's an audience for you. And you can find them and they will find you. It wasn't always that case. Now it is.
Yeah. Tell us about your masterworks.
Yeah. So
explain what the project is for the uninitiated and then talk about how it came.
Well, OK, for all of my career, since, you know, I have been pretty public with other magicians with my work and stuff like that, they've always asked me, you know, am I going to publish a book? Are you going to publish a book? Why haven't you published a book? All the kind of stuff. Because as you and I both are, I mean, you look behind both of us, we've got books. We love books. I learn lots of things from books. I use books for reference all the time. So I use every, you know, possible way of learning about magic. So it just occurred to me that if I'm going to do a book project, if I'm going to do a book, I'm going to do the books. And by that, I mean, I'm going to go back through my entire career and I'm going to take all of the hits. So basically, Masterworks is about everything I've ever done that I think is worthy of going in to a book. 54 years of my creations, all in three books, and then everybody can stop bothering me. Because it'll all be there. And if anybody's interested in Masterworks, I've got kind of an unusual way of doing it. Instead of taking pre-orders for it, I'm basically doing subscriptions. Now, I don't want people to think that it's a subscription in any traditional form. What it basically means is that you prepay for the three books. And then as I'm creating pieces, I will send them to you so that you can sort of keep me honest on my production schedule and know that I'm doing something. And then when the book gets finished and printed, then you get the printed copy as well. So it's just a little bonus. So you get to have some fun as I am taking on this huge design project.
I think it's wonderful in the world of magic publishing that somebody's trying something different and doing it in a different way. But you ready for the segue?
Of course.
Okay. Talking of big projects, you're lecturing for Masterclass.
I know. It seems like all that my name is now is big projects, but I love that because that's what I love. I love a challenge.
Now, this is exciting, and I've heard astonishing things about the lectures. Can you tell us a little bit about the myriad of topics that you're going to be covering, Dan Harlan, during the month of March?
Yes, my masterclass is about a topic that is very near and dear to me. That is the most maligned technique in mentalism. It is the most misused, misunderstood, and it is the best one of all. If you are a mentalist, you are slightly familiar with this technique. If you are a magician, you know very little about it, generally speaking. But if you care about good magic and mentalism, you absolutely have to add it to your repertoire, and you have to do it properly. So the technique that I'm talking about is equivocation. Now, you've probably heard it called equivoque or equivoque. Those are both wrong. It is equivocation. That's the word. So number one, let's talk about it using a term that actually makes sense that you can look up in the dictionary that is what you're doing. So it is not just about verbally equivocating something. It can also be physically. It can also be psychologically. Equivocation is the idea that something seems to have a very definite meaning. Doesn't matter what that thing is, whether it's physically existent or psychologically or ideologically or whatever. It seems to have a very clear meaning, and yet it can be interpreted in at least two ways, generally speaking, multiple ways. That is equivocation.
Okay, I'll tell you what. I'll ask you three questions. You pick two of them. And then leave me with the one that you don't want.
And that's not equivocation. But see, that's not equivocation. This is why it's misunderstood. Damien, it's not this, right? Let me give you, based on that, I'll give you a simple example of what equivocation really is, okay? So I have three questions.
Hit me.
And whatever question you take from me, that's the one that you're going to use. You see, that's equivocation. Yeah. What I've said is very clear.
It was just a dumb joke.
No, I know. It was but just the problem a dumb is joke. that equivocation is often thought of as a joke, because when you see somebody who doesn't do it well, it's transparent, mm-hmm. It's obvious, it doesn't fool anybody. Here's the problem is that it comes from some very odd sources, and the original sources of it. The one that we could go back and find, the oldest source of it was the worst. And it's been based around that the whole time. It's like, you know, I have two things, take one from me. And now we just continue with either that one or this one. And that's it. That was like the original source. It was there's no clarity in that vision. So what I've done, and what I've done in my whole career, and I'm really well known for this, I've done a thorough study of real equivocation through both the lens of a magician, through the lens of mentalists who were very good at it, and also in public venues such as politics and corporate doublespeak. So in studying all of that, what I wanted to do is I wanted to gel it into such a way that I could utilize it in decision making, where it seemed truly to be fair, to truly be where I am not going to influence anything in any way. And not only that, I'm also going to actually agree with every choice that my participant makes. I'm going to follow anything that they do, whatever they do. will have meaning and intention and continue. And that makes it completely different from what you've ever dealt with. Basic thing behind it, without going heavily into the masterclass, is that no matter what you're doing, no matter what you're what decision you're trying to influence, there's always going to be a target. So a target and then everything else. And so you have to follow just the target. It really comes down to a bifurcating path that either contains the target or doesn't contain the target. And all you have to do is make both of those meaningful. And the thing that I like to bring to all the magic that I do, and in this case in particular, these are not dull routines. These are not, you know, pick one thing and it's predicted. No. There are many, many really fascinating, interesting, fun presentations that are going on with all of the stuff that I work with. So there's stuff with like with lollipops and cuff chains and a lock and keys and there's stuff with money and things for a garage sale and pictures and I mean just unbelievably interesting ways of presenting it. And by the time you're done with this masterclass, you will be looking at equivocation in a totally different way. It will no longer be what you thought it was. You know, I challenge you, watch this masterclass and see how much you learn. It doesn't matter how good you are at it. You will be surprised and enlightened and assisted by the things that you learn. If you've never thought about using equivocation, take the masterclass, because you're going to look at it a different way. And you're going to go, oh, I get it. I finally understand why it's good. So you have to see what I am doing with it to realize, just like I said, it is the strongest mentalism technique that you can use. And of course, you can use it for magic. There are things that I suggest for performing magic tricks. They don't come off as mentalism, but at their core, at the heart of them, they are equivocal. Everybody should do it.
Dan Harlan, we are just about out of time, but we always finish the show with four quick fire questions. Are you ready?
That's question number one. Now, question number two.
Okay, we always finish the show with five quick fire questions. Are you ready? Favorite pizza topping?
I like green peppers and mushrooms. So it's kind of hard because everything else can go in there. But it used to be mushrooms, but my fiance, Sarah Allen, and I got engaged, by the way. Yay. Thank you so much. She's allergic to mushrooms, which is sad.
Kick her to the curb, man. She might be able to remember fish, but if she doesn't like mushrooms,
so I like you could put everything else that you want on there, but I would want those green peppers. Most people wouldn't go for them, but that little burst of the liquid and the slight peppery taste just help the palate to open up.
Favorite movie?
Metropolis.
Favorite person or people that make music?
Pink Floyd.
Who would you rather fight, 100 tiny Andes or one massive Joshua?
Well, that's 100 tiny Andes.
I love the fact that you didn't even pause.
There's a swarm. But no, one massive Joshua, that's no fight at all. I'd be, he's just smoosh, right? It'd be annoying to fight tiny Andes. They'd be all over you, right? But there's no fight against Joshua. You don't even have to make him any bigger. I'm not fighting him.
Dan Harlan's Vanishing Ink Masterclass kicks off this Sunday, and it's all right because you've already been paid. But you can take out a trial subscription to Masterclass for $1.
For $1, you can't go wrong. No matter what the typical price is, I over-delivered. I will tell you that.
$50, right? Dan.
It's what?
$50.
That's cheap. Yeah.
Which is still a bargain.
Such a great
5 hours plus the live Q&A.
Great deal. But if you have any hesitation whatsoever, just try what I have there for a buck. Oh, you know, this is the thing. Sign up for a buck and then just send me the other $49. You're going to want to.
Dan Herman, thank you so much for giving us so much of your time and your insight. I appreciate you and I appreciate what you've done. And I thank you.
Thanks, Damien. I've had a great time.